All right, everybody, it's 1 o'clock, so we're going to start our webinar here today. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Sustainable Resilient Remediation, also known as SRR. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Washington, D.C. So this training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document, Sustainable Resilient Remediation, which was produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Excuse me, some housekeeping rules for today. The training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page that brought you here today has the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. None of the links in the PowerPoint slide deck today will be active as it is screen shared. So if you would like to access those links, please download the training materials from the CLUIN training page. In Zoom, you can ask questions, report any technical difficulties, or any comments in the Q&A pod at any time during the training. We will have two Q&A sessions today, the first about halfway through, and the second at the end of the training. If we have too many questions to address, during those live portions, we will ask our trainers to respond directly to those questions via the Q&A pod. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training today. Once you complete the form, you'll have the opportunity to certify that you participated by checking a box on the form, and then a certificate will be emailed to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members on ITRC's Sustainable Resilient Team and have volunteered to not only build the training, but keep it running over the course of the years. A special thank you to them for that volunteer time and for participating today. If you would like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios on the CLUIN training page. So with that, I'm going to move to the next slide and hand it off to John Doyne with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection.
Good morning. Welcome, everybody, to the ITRC Sustainable Resilient Remediation Training. I'm going to give you a brief introduction and I'll be handing it off to Tom O'Neill. All right, so why don't we start off with a definition, Sustainable Resilient Remediation, an optimized solution to cleaning up and reusing hazardous waste sites. It limits negative environmental impacts while maximizing social and economic benefits. It creates resilience against increasing threats due to climate change. This is a document that evolved from prior ITRC documents that were addressing green and sustainable remediation. They were produced in 2011. What we've done is we've added a strong resiliency component along with a chapter in considerations of social and economic costs and benefits of cleanups, along with the environmental cost and benefits. So why sustainable resilient remediation? Well, we've seen increases in frequency and magnitude of extreme weather events, increased flooding, the number of strength of hurricanes. Climate patterns are shifting, increased flooding in areas while drought in other areas. We've also seen increases in sea levels along the coastal communities and along with storm events. This causes inundation and erosion. And not only does this impact our everyday lives, but it also has a potential to impact our contaminated sites, undermining the goal that we were all attempting to do, which is to, you know, protect human health and the environment. But because of extreme weather events, contaminated sites can become vulnerable to flooding, fires, wind damage, and power outages. This is actually a picture of a site in New Jersey on the Passaic River. I think it was operating for about 6 months when we had a storm, shut it down for 2 years. Basically, it wasn't good for anybody. So what are we doing? In this document, we address two basic actions: sustainable actions and resiliency actions. Sustainable actions reduce carbon footprint, utilize natural green resources throughout the project, use clean renewable energy in place of carbon fuels, and overall optimize the remedial activities. The resiliency actions assess vulnerabilities to climate impacts, address those vulnerabilities through remedial design, and incorporate the resiliency into the remedies. So some of the things that we have in this document, one of the things is frequently asked questions that not only address the questions, but also tie it to case studies to show as examples of how these things are addressed. This is something that Tom is going to go into much more detail with. We also have, we did a study or a survey of state regulators back in fall of 2019. It includes responses from all 50 states and discusses opportunities and barriers that were perceived by these regulators with regard to sustainable resilient remediation. Another key piece of the document is an interactive online map that provides resources, both state and federal resources for the different areas. This is something that Tom's also going to go into in much more detail. And we also have incorporated the social and economic dimensions of sustainability, adding things like the US EPA environmental justice screening layer. I think Elizabeth's going to talk about that a little bit. We also have stakeholder assessments, the social and economic benefit analysis tools that are discussed. One of the key pieces is the updated framework. It illustrates how and why you would tie sustainability and resilience into the overall remedial project lifecycle. This is something Roy's going to go into a lot more detail, as well as, I believe, Michelle. There is a sustainable best management practice checklist. It's interactive. It's a great tool to get a real good idea of what sustainable tools are out there and that are applicable to the site. You just go through it and you can tie it to a lot of the different aspects of that might be specific to your site. Michelle's going to discuss this in a lot more detail also. We have case studies. Here's three examples. There's the Senator Joseph Finnegan Park in Boston, Massachusetts, the Harrison Avenue landfill in Camden, New Jersey, and the Bellingham waterfront in the state of Washington. And the last piece is the future recommendations. This provides things like recommending demonstrations that value that additional case studies that can show a value of sustainable resilient remediation, development of metrics to better track sustainable resilient remediation, and things like further guidance and standardized methods for conducting vulnerability assessments. And with that, I think I'm going to pass it over to Tom O'Neill. Tom?
Thank you, John. This is Tom O'Neill. I'm coming to you from Rahway, New Jersey, and my part of the presentation is to go over the resources that we have available in the document and go over section two, which provides information on the background of how we got to this point and developing our thoughts on SRR and what the value of SRR is to you in conducting your site remediation. So what we have here are the resources that are available within the major resources that are available within the document where you can find them. The resources help you find the information within the document and how to navigate the document. And most importantly, they all can be used to help you document the work that you do, which will improve the transparency of how you came to your conclusions and how you build in resiliency and sustainability into your project so that you can explain it to your internal and external stakeholders. And the way I like to put it, keep your mind right with regard to sustainability and resiliency and organized. You'll see some of these resources are available within the document, and some of them we point out to resources that are available outside of the ITRC document. The first of those resources, John noted, is the state resource map. It's a map of the United States, and it's interactive. It allows you to click on a particular state and find out what we could find with regard to resiliency, sustainability within those states. And we organized it by laws and regulations, executive orders, and so on. So the classes of information. And this is what it looks like on the ITRC website when you come to it. And I want you to take note of the key resources. Again, we organized it as best we could in a logical manner so that you could find what you need, from the laws and regulations to executive orders, if it's policy and guidance, if it's some other type of resource. These case studies here are additional case studies. These are not the ones that we have within the document. These are case studies that are found as we're navigating and trying to find resiliency and sustainability resources for you. As if they are outside links, they often change, and we do our best to try and keep it updated. But if you find a broken link or you know of a resource that's better than the ones we have, let us know. There's a blue button on the screen that lets you provide feedback, and we'll do our best to update that map. So how do we navigate this resource map? What you do is you simply click on your state, and I'm going to pick New Jersey because that's where I spent 37 years in publicly funded site remediation and have seen the changes and the approach to resiliency and sustainability over those years. So you simply click on the state, it'll pop up a blue box, and it'll identify the types of resources that we were able to find for that state. In this case, we found green and sustainable resources, climate resilience, and wildfire resilience. Now, you wouldn't normally think New Jersey is a wildfire state, but it is. And we have many sites, from Superfund sites on down, in areas that are threatened by wildfire, for example. And there's a federal resources button. Most of these are general federal resources on the topic areas presented by the document. However, there are some state specific federal resources that are mixed in with that. This is a common button. Every state you click on, you'll find this federal resources button. So you can click on that and it'll give you information. So what you do is you simply click on this box again, and it will bring up the resources that we have identified for the state. So in this case, we blew up just a portion of the information that's available there so you could actually read it. This is the statute that directed NJDEP to encourage the use of green and sustainable practice during site remediation. We have a hyperlink to the legislative page, and we have a hyperlink to the actual document itself. And that's very typical of the screen that you would get from the state resources map. The case studies, there are four case studies that are detailed, and I mean very well fleshed out in section 5. These are within the document itself, developed by the team with cooperation of the partners that did the work on these projects so that we could identify cases where sustainability and resiliency were successfully implemented at the projects. And they provide examples of how it was done at different times during the remedial process. So I really direct your attention to Section 5 and look at these case studies that are within the document itself. Another tool we have is the lifecycle and framework integration screen. I'm going to just give you a quick preview of how to navigate it itself. It's a navigation and project management tool. As a former manager or project managers, I love the way it's organized in that you can see the remediation process across the top. You can see the various site remediation and resiliency concepts arrayed below it, and then you can find out what you're interested in and move to it quickly. And it also provides that ability to document, you know, the work that you're doing within the particular phase that you're working on. So say you're interested in stakeholder engagement, click on the stakeholder engagement bar. It will bring you to the stakeholder engagement section within our document. And again, this is only a portion of that section blown up. So hopefully you can see it. And I just wanted to point out within here, we do have hyperlinks to our citations, and then we have hover over buttons. So if you're not familiar with a particular term, such as environmental justice or risk management, you hover over that and you'll get a definition of those particular terms. And those are positioned throughout the document. So we also have a return to the framework. What we've discovered over time is these documents need to have an array of navigation tools themselves. So say you're done with stakeholder engagement review and you want to go to, say, conceptual site model, simply hit the return to the framework and bring it back to the main document integration tool. And then you can navigate from there. Other resources that we have available within the document include the case study matrix, which is in Appendix A. John showed you a little bit of it before. What is really nice about that, I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail later. And then the Section 2, the case studies that are the well-fleshed out ones that show you how resiliency and sustainability were successfully integrated into real projects. And as the frequently asked questions, things like, what is the value of SRR and why should I use it at my site? What's important about this is you may be interested in doing it, but it has in the past not been a frequently raised topic for actually conducting remediation. So you may need to be able to explain it to your internal stakeholders or external stakeholders. Why am I want to spend time on resiliency and sustainability, and how will it improve my project? The frequently asked questions will give you answers to that. And then, as John pointed out, will give you concrete case study linkages so that you can see how it was done on real sites. The tech sheets are sheets, an example of a sheet on how you can organize your thoughts on green and sustainable remediation. It's an outline. We give you an example. And again, it's, like I said before, how to keep your mind right about green and sustainable remediation. It's a complex topic. We give you a way to organize your thoughts. What are the regulations nationally, locally, and regionally around your site? What are the risk profile for your site? So it's a way to organize that in a single sheet. And then we'll talk about the sustainable best management checklists later on. It's in Section 7. And then in Appendix D is where the actual working checklist is. Okay, so in the summary, the state resources map is where you can go to find out what's going on locally and to a degree nationally. It helps you frame your thoughts about sustainability and resiliency. It allows you to compare state to state. You know, say you're working in one state, and but you're near another one, or you may have heard that such and such a state was working on something. You can go there and see whether you can find more information on it. This our framework helps you navigate the document. It lets you move between topic areas within the document. It helps you manage your project, and it helps you document your work. And then the case studies provide that examples of successful integration of sustainability and resiliency. Section 2, which is the history of SRR and importance and value, is really why we're here. As John pointed out earlier, we have seen changes over time. When we were originally, and speaking as somebody that started in the remediation world in the early 1980s, we were interested in mitigating the risk. And we are continuing to say you have to mitigate the risk represented by that site. But there are other things that are threatening that site, the external environmental impacts, that's the resiliency considerations. And then the site itself represents its own set of values and risks to its surroundings, its environment, its community setting. That's the sustainability aspect. So we'll get into that. We'll talk a little bit more about that case study matrix and those frequently asked questions. Okay. Over time, our approach to hazardous sites and remediation has changed. Back in the early days, pre-regulation, industry and individuals were pretty much free to do what they could do as long as they're a nuisance to their neighbors. And even if they were, they sometimes didn't matter. They could dispose of wastes basically anywhere. As a result of that, in high profile sites like Love Canal, Times Beach, and Chem Control, just to name a few, large scale regulations started coming into effect. The Superfund program, the RCRA program, in the early 80s, and then we started doing government and industry and communities doing remediation in big ways, big dig and dump projects, moving hazardous materials from uncontrolled environments to controlled landfills, bringing them to incinerators to destroy them, installing large-scale pump and treat systems, very intensive treatments. As that progressed and regulations kept moving forward into things like voluntary cleanup programs and brownfields, we started also thinking about how could we make the remediation process greener? Could we use solar in place of certain power? Could we use biofuels in our heavy equipment or on-site generation capacity, things like that. Now we're moving into a period where we realize that the work that we did early on these sites, and some of these sites are 20, 30, almost 40 years old, we didn't necessarily think of all the external threats, the resiliency threats of flood, fire, wildfire, and so on. Nor did we fully conceptualize how the setting of the site impacted its environment or the communities around it. And that's what we're looking at in the 2020s and beyond, is the SRR components. How we got here, there are a series of documents that led to this document that we're talking about today. There's others. But these are keystone documents, and I'm going to touch on them. While they are starting to get a little older, they are still of value, and we highly recommend that you take a look at them. They each have their own perspective and sets of tools within them that you can use, and they're all complementary. So the first one is what is commonly referred to as the green remediation primer by the EPA. It really started the thinking of intentionally incorporating green and sustainable concepts into the remediation process as, and I'll use the word again, a complementary process. It's not in place of the standard considerations for site remediation. We're still 100% protecting human health and environment. There's different ways to do it. And one of the different ways to do it is to balance the how you're using your energy and how the site sits in its land and ecosystems environment, the chart that's represented there. One of the next documents that came out was the Sustainable Remediation Forum's white paper. They examined what had been going on in the world of green and sustainable remediation, found examples and tools and metrics for how to evaluate when something is green and how sustainable. And they introduced the Venn diagram there that shows the balance between economic, social, and environmental issues surrounding sustainability. Elizabeth will be bringing more of that up in her section. And John touched on part of it. We also had the pair of ITRC documents on green and sustainable remediation. The first one was a technology overview document that introduced the topic to state regulators and the people who work with them. Again, at the time, it was more of a newer topic, so we got some definitional issues out of the way, identified the problems. And then we moved into the technical regulatory guidance document, which established a framework for how you could actually practically put it into your process. And it's set up so they can do it at any phase of the remediation, from the very earliest to the very end game of your remediation. We recommend you do it as early as possible. But it also breaks it down into a multi-level approach. You can do it as a qualitative, a semi-quantitative, or a fully quantitative process, and the tech reg guidance document shows you how. Why is it valuable? Why are we here? Sites are threatened, and again, the threatened by the external environment is the resiliency side. When they're threatened, and John gave you the example of the site that was damaged by Sandy. Things happen. The breakout button here shows that 60% of non-federal NPL sites are in harm's way. And our example that we gave of that New Jersey site illustrates that. If we had thought back in the early 80s when we designed that site, for more flood protection, maybe we could have prevented the costs of that shutdown, which is replacing controls, air compressors, transformers, and everything else by properly designing, designing it so that the Passaic River didn't flood out and damage, the controls we needed to run that site. It's a physical cost, there's a time component to the shutdown of the site, and there's a social impact. The site was actually moving towards what some of our federal friends called ready for reuse. But it was getting to the point where it was essentially cleaned up and getting ready to entertain people for redevelopment. But the site flooded, system got shut down, and that delayed that effort considerably. So there's cost of money, and there's cost of time, and there's cost of human resources going to deal with recovery from that, resiliency that we didn't have at the site. It converted itself into a sustainability issue going forward. So we also have the case study matrix in Appendix A. This is organized in a way so you can find the information that you want the way you want to find it. It's in a Excel spreadsheet. There's a number of different filters and ways to search out the information. We list some of the ways you can do it here on this slide. I like to use the example of the regulatory programs. I work largely in New Jersey publicly funded work and Superfund. But I also had occasion to work on sites or underground storage tank sites, brownfield sites, and voluntary cleanup sites that failed. So I would use this chart, find information on underground storage tanks, for example, you know, an area that was not my initial thrust for work, and I could find information about, say, underground storage tank cases and a successful application of sustainability and resiliency issues there. So why are we here? We're here really to make the remediation successful. And as we framed it before, we need to look at sustainability, which is the remedies impact on the environment around it, the community around it, in the light of resiliency, which is the environment's impact on the site. You know, is the site's risk profile now changed from the time it was found and the initial remedial measures put in place? They're really two sides of the same coin. If you're not being resilient, you're threatening the sustainability aspects. And if you're not, you know, looking at that sustainability, you may not be sensitive to the resiliency that you want to build into the project. So that will help make your remediation successful. It will help you not waste resources by poor planning. And by poor planning, we're positing that if you're not thinking about sustainability and resiliency, that's part of that planning process. We want you to build it into it. If it's an existing site, that's fine. If it's one you're just starting to work on, do it then. It's the best time. Early on is best. And then you have to think about the end game and how the site is impacting the environment around it and the communities that are around it. And what is going to be the end game for that site? What is going to be best for the environment and community with that site? And with that, and I will pass the program over to Elizabeth, and she'll bring you up to speed on social and economic evaluations and benefits.
Thanks, Tom. So I'm going to introduce you to Section 5 of the guidance. And as Tom just said, it's focused on the social and economic factors of sustainable resilient remediation. Devin, I'm having trouble. Oh, thank you. So Section 5 expands on information about and resources for the social and economic dimensions of sustainability, including state-of-the-art social and economic evaluation tools. And Roy and Michelle will go into more details about that later on. So this slide provides you a quick overview of the variety of information you can find in Section 5, such as the role of environmental justice, most importantly, linking the outcomes identified by all the stakeholders to measurable metrics, how ecosystem services play a critical role, and plenty of resources and tools. This is a diagram from an EPA document, so I apologize if it's blurry for some of you. It's a picture of a picture. But the social pillar represents, in very broad terms, public policies that support social issues. These social issues relate to our well-being and include aspects such as healthcare, education, housing, the equitable distribution of goods and services to a community, and culture. In terms of a sustainable, resilient cleanup, we're talking about approaches and decisions that address issues such as environmental justice, human health, community engagement and empowerment, and sustainable communities. The economic pillar of sustainability refers to strategies that utilize socioeconomic resources to their best advantage. From the sustainable and resilient perspective, economic examples include both temporary and permanent job creation related to the cleanup and reuse of the property, and the potential for site cleanup activities to trigger wider long-term investments or development in the area. As I mentioned earlier, sustainability is more than an environmental concept that asks us to be efficient with resources. It is an integrated and holistic concept that also involves economic progress and enhances human equity. Because there has been this perception that economic and social concerns are external to cleanup, Section 5 attempts to dispel this perception and demonstrate that the social and economic factors are actually integral to the cleanup and to addressing the concerns and needs of the community. It provides discussion and direction on how you can effectively incorporate the social and economic factors into your SRR project. As discussed in Section 5, project teams must engage the community early in the process and ensure that the engagement is continued throughout the cleanup process. First, the project team must identify and consider the impacts of the cleanup on the community. This can be done by truly listening to the community and gathering both empirical and qualitative data, such as the community's historical perspective of the site and the community's vision for its cleanup and reuse. It's important to understand how a site or its cleanup might affect different neighborhoods in different ways, including displacement resulting from gentrification. Thoughtful, transparent, and tailored community engagement is critical for successful and sustainable cleanup and redevelopment. A solid SRR project can often result in lower costs, more effective and resilient remedies, and an open, trusting, and collaborative relationship with the community and stakeholders. So this slide is a visual representation of community engagement as discussed in Section 5. Before undertaking any communication or planning activities with stakeholders, the project team should identify and discuss any known or anticipated stakeholder values for the cleanup project. An easy way to do this initial step is through a desktop review of community demographic data. Searching local news and social media can help a project team initially assess stakeholder needs and concerns. This part of the stakeholder engagement process is considered pre-stage. Now, not all projects require the same level of engagement. Determination of the level of engagement and who you should engage needs to be made during the project planning stage and revisited as new stakeholder concerns and needs arise and as your relationship with the community evolves. Using this approach, you'll find that individual stakeholders' interests in and influence on a project may change over time, necessitating a revised or more comprehensive engagement strategy. Stage one is identified as the first official stage of the engagement process and involves reaching out to stakeholders in ways comfortable to them to define early SRR objectives and values. Although, as noted previously, the pre-stage part is critical for success at this stage. Stage two involves the project team's evaluating whether the proposed remedial actions are in line with the stakeholders' needs, concerns, and values. If any conflicts arise, this is where you would want to develop a plan to address them. This conflict check-in may help avoid a prolonged conflict that could lead to project delays, uncertainties in public acceptance, or unwanted negative press. Finally, stage three of the roadmap takes place during the remediation activities and involves continued communication with the stakeholders on progress, updates, and early identification of conflicts that may arise. Section 5 also recognizes that there are strong and well-known correlations between the locations of environmental contamination and the neighborhoods of people of color and low-income residents. Minority, low-income, and Indigenous communities are often the most vulnerable and overburdened by environmental and public health stressors, and therefore deserve special consideration and thus are a specific topic of discussion in this guidance. The emphasis is on fair treatment and meaningful involvement. As noted in Section 5, even the most well-intentioned project team can perpetuate these systemic disparities if they fail to address them in project planning, execution, and operation. The guidance identifies several key factors for you to consider. One, robust stakeholder engagement is crucial for achieving meaningful SRR outcomes in communities with environmental justice concerns. Two, don't assume that the lead organization and other decision makers understand the concerns of the people in the surrounding communities. Likewise, situated communities may have completely different needs and concerns. Recognize that people may be suspicious that the lead organization is telling the truth, cares about them, or is even willing to work with them. Research the full range of opinions and concerns, including general attitude, knowledge, and perceptions about the cleanup activities. And finally, regularly ask community leaders and the stakeholders if there are other groups or individuals who are missing from the outreach and who should be included. I thought it may be helpful to give you a flavor of one of the resources mentioned in the guidance. EJ Screen is an EPA environmental justice screening and mapping tool that utilizes data to highlight places that may have higher environmental burdens and vulnerable populations. It provides EPA with a nationally consistent data set and approach for combining environmental and demographic, social, socioeconomic indicators. EJ Screen So as a user, you would choose a geographic location, and then the tool provides demographic, socioeconomic, and environmental information for that area. All EJ Screen indicators are publicly available data. EJ Screen simply provides a way to display the information and includes a method for combining environmental and demographic indicators into what we call EJ indexes. Last month, EPA released an EJ Screen 2.1, and the update features the addition of new data on U.S. territories, supplemental indexes, threshold maps, and refreshed demographic and environmental data. The U.S. territories information includes environmental, demographic, and index data for the U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, America, Samoa, and the Northern Mariana Islands. Supplemental indexes are included as an additional method to highlight vulnerable communities that may be disproportionately impacted by pollution. They use the same methodology and calculation as the EJ indexes, but incorporate a new five-factor supplemental demographic index, which includes percentage of low income, percentage of unemployed, percentage of limited English speaking, percentage of the population that has less than a high school education, and the percentage of low life expectancy. So as you can see on the right side of the slide, EJ Screen offers a variety of data and mapping capabilities at high geographic resolution across the entire country. This information is displayed in color-coded maps and standard data reports. These maps and reports show how your selected location compares to the rest of the nation, a particular EPA region, or a state. For SRR purposes, EJ Screen can help inform outreach and engagement practices, prioritize cleanup work, and enhance place-based activities. EPA also added data sets pertaining to climate change and climate vulnerability that you may find relevant to your project. And I believe that just yesterday, EJ Screen was updated in the Superfund SEMS, the Superfund system, site tracking system. So it will now capture the use of the supplemental indexes I just described. And just so you know, US EPA does not have the only EJ tool. Here are some examples of states that have their own environmental justice tools, screening tools. So in the overview slide, I mentioned the importance of linking the outcomes identified by the stakeholders to measurable metrics. A level one evaluation is a qualitative assessment to those social and economic preferred management practices that you can adopt and incorporate into your cleanup project that promote quality of life improvements and mitigate unintended impacts that directly affect the community. Section 5 provides quite a few tools to undertake each evaluation level. from a simple pre-planning checklist to a more substantial or more robust quantitative analysis. And both Roy and Michelle will go into that aspect in more detail. Level 2 evaluation combines the selection and implementation of sustainable management practices with some degree of qualitative or semi-quantitative evaluation. In Level 2, stakeholders present their preference on criteria used to select a proposed project, remediation alternative, or preferred land use scenario. And finally, Level 3 evaluation combines the selection and implementation of sustainable management practices with a rigorous quantitative evaluation. This level of evaluation assesses how site cleanup and restoration activities may result in beneficial or unintended social, economic, and environmental impacts. One of the most important steps in... So it is in section 5, we describe how the importance of documenting the outcomes of the project and measuring progress toward goals. And part of this is to clearly identify desirable outcomes or benefits from the outset and linking them to relevant metrics or progress indicators where possible. These metrics can be chosen to fit the context of a specific project. And Section 5 provides those tools to do that. Reviewing and choosing metrics at the beginning of the project can also help guide the identification of project goals and selection of more diverse benefit categories. Stakeholders should be consulted when selecting metrics to build consensus and reduce the chance for controversy over proposed sustainable resilient outcomes. Examples of social and economic indicators include the health and safety of site workers and the surrounding community through alleviating, preventing, or mitigating contamination risks, stakeholder engagement, where the project team records and publishes the transparency of decisions to local communities, the community's degree of engagement to identify beneficial and undesirable impacts, the development of future land use and design, and alleviating undesirable community impacts such as noise, traffic congestion, business disruptions, and compromising local heritage and cultural concerns. As many of you already know, brownfield sites are former or current commercial or industrial facilities that are currently vacant or underutilized and on which there has been or there's suspected to have been a release of a contaminant. Most of these sites are in urban settings that are in lower socioeconomic communities. These communities are also commonly located in areas that are vulnerable to impacts from climate change. From an environmental justice perspective, the remediation of these sites is a priority for many states and for this administration. Notably, incorporation of sustainability and resiliency into all aspects of brownfields remediation benefits both site redevelopment and the surrounding community. Social and economic factors can be represented as indicators of either beneficial or unintended impacts of cleanup and restoration activities. These indicators are helpful when articulating what socioeconomic impacts mean in the context of the project and in measurable ways to define and evaluate a project's broader sustainable and resilient risk management goals. To exemplify these types of indicators, a U.S. EPA five-year study of brownfield sites found that residential property values increased from 5% to 13% after a nearby brownfield was either assessed or cleaned up. The study also went on to determine that brownfield cleanups can increase overall property values within a one-mile radius by from anywhere from $500,000 to $1.5 million. An example of one of the resources identified in the SRR guidance is the Climate Smart Brownfield Manual. It provides a comprehensive approach for communities on climate mitigation, adaptation, and resiliency for redeveloping these kinds of sites. If you, your client, or community plans to apply for a brownfield grant, incorporating sustainable and resilient management practices into your application is considered more favorably over an application that lacks this information. Ecosystem services are the specific benefits provided by an ecosystem that contribute to human health and well-being, or have the potential to do so in the future. Ecosystem services that benefit humans, such as pollination and flood control, typically are not fully accounted for in economic markets, policy decisions, or individual projects. There are lots of different types of ecosystem services, and quite often the benefits from nature that people and communities receive from a cleanup result in the availability of ecosystem services, even if that term is not explicitly used. The identification and measurement of ecosystem services can be part of calculating the total environmental footprint of contaminated site remediation. First, site-specific ecosystem services may be identified by working with a site team and through your stakeholder engagement process. The selected ecosystem services may be quantified using existing information or through the identification of data that you may need to collect. Once relevant ecosystem services are quantified, your next step is to examine them in the context of the identified management practices. Appropriate management practices implementation can result in ecosystem protection, enhancement, and revitalization, which minimizes the environmental footprint of cleanup operations. Implementation can also help inform discussions with the community on the cleanup and determine future land use options, which may include ecosystem services for the site. Identification of beneficiaries, that is, who benefits, is essential to the identification of ecosystem services. Community groups, tribes, municipalities, and other stakeholders are examples of beneficiaries of a cleanup site's environmental benefits and ecosystem services. Stakeholder knowledge and values help inform evaluations of environmental and ecosystem services benefits. Ecosystems management and conservation activities are common methods to protect ecosystems and maintain the services they provide, avoiding the need for costly alternatives of those environmental services. Two main ways to assign values to ecosystem services are avoided costs, which refer to the costs of developing engineering alternatives that are not incurred because actions are taken to protect or preserve ecosystem services, and replacement costs, which refer to the costs of engineered systems to replace ecosystem services, for example, an engineered stormwater system to replace natural functions. So this is, Tom and John mentioned, there are plenty of case studies in the SRR guidance. And I just pulled a couple of examples out. And this is Phoenix Park in Camden, New Jersey. And this is a before and after photo, which was officially a Phoenix Park, which was officially opened in 2015. And this 5-acre riverfront park was once home to a factory on the Delaware River that made, chalk and other products for about 100 years. And there were even low levels of radiation found at this site. So Camden County's Municipal Utility Authority needed to figure out a way to deal with both stormwater and wastewater as separate streams. The authority worked in conjunction with New Jersey DEP and local community needed open space that often system. This brought agencies and led to the creation of a garden oasis for the surrounding communities. Phoenix Park represents what happens when the social and economic factors of sustainable, resilient remediation are integrated into a cleanup. They support redevelopment, provide important local services, and build bridges with disaffected communities. Phoenix Park illustrates the goals of Chapter 5, recognizing the importance of social and economic aspects of sustainability, including a multi-level partnership, extensive community outreach, and addressing environmental justice issues in ecosystem services. Incorporating the social and economic factors into site reuse planning and implementation turned this brownfield redevelopment into a shared resource that enjoys broad community support. This slide represents the cleanup and engagement approach used by Washington State Department of Ecology. If you recall an earlier slide where I described the the community engagement process, you can see the overlap of the ITRC conceptual stakeholder assessment roadmap and the roadmap used by Washington State. The orange bubbles represent public participation. As you can see, public participation is critical at each stage of cleanup and reuse. Outreach and engagement are vital to the successful SRR outcome. So this is the Bellingham Bay Initiative, and the picture on the left represents the before, and the one on the right is the after, and the shot in the middle is just a close-up of the cleanup areas. And this initiative brought together 14 government and industry organizations working along with residents and businesses with an interest in improving the health of the Bay. The Bellingham Bay Initiative is an example of what can be accomplished when multiple agencies and organizations collaborate and work with stakeholders to plan cleanups that meet the needs of the local communities using principles of integrated project planning and public participation in decision making. And as background, Bellingham Bay has an industrial history as a key port for lumber processing, creation of paper goods, and other maritime trades. As with many other industries, advances in technology and a changing local economy led to some of those businesses closing doors or leaving town for other locations. And when these businesses left or shut down, they did not take their hazardous waste with them. The Bellingham Bay Demonstration Project resulted in the development of a comprehensive strategic environmental planning document that incorporated the social and economic factors of SRR. It serves as a national model for comprehensive environmental management. It's helping to revitalize the community's waterfront. It identified 19 high priority habitat restoration projects and controlled the pollution sources. Today, on the Bellingham waterfront, there are new infrastructure improvements, community amenities, including a park and kayak launch, social support, including a public meeting space and job training center, restoration of critical habitat, and places for local businesses. By taking the time to identify all these co-uses and learn what the community needed, this project has turned into a win for everyone involved. This vibrant waterfront brings people together, includes plans to provide affordable housing, provides rental income to the port and tax income to the city, and improves the health of residents and that of the natural environment. As illustrated by Phoenix Park in Bellingham Bay, you can only get so far by considering and assessing impacts on social, economic, and environmental factors of a project on your own. By incorporating stakeholder engagement sessions as part of the effort, you are much more likely to get a comprehensive understanding of perspectives, increase communication and trust, and create an environment where the best possible outcome is likely. In summary, Section 5 lays out the framework to collect data, engage the community, think about the future and resiliency, remember ecosystem services, and make the world a better place. Now I'm going to turn it back to Devin to open us up for questions and then a short break. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. We are going to jump right into our first Q&A section here. So our first question is, I'm interested in any examples of ecosystem services measurements for a cleanup and restoration of radioactive contaminated site. Do you have any examples of this?
I don't off the top of my head, but if Devin, if you can get the person's name and number, I can get back in touch with them and see if I do, if we do have any examples. I don't know if John or Roy or Tom or Michelle have any examples.
No worry. I will make a note of the individual asking and we will follow up with you directly. All right. So I'll move to another question. How would you suggest identifying the needs or concerns of a community? Would polling be an option? How do you know who the real community leaders are and if they're actually representative of the people or are they more self-selected? If you have any thoughts on this, please share.
Hi, well, this is Elizabeth again. Well, I think, as I mentioned, I think the first step is just to, you know, go online and do a search, whatever your search tool is, to see if there have been articles printed up, if there have been op-ed pieces, if there have been community meetings. So, for example, there's actually a, it's not a Superfund site, but it's a landfill, and there are two adjacent communities to this landfill in Louisville, Kentucky, and one community uses it. So there's a wooded area surrounding the landfill, and one community uses it to go, you know, hunting. They use their three wheelers, et cetera. The other community considers it a environmental hazard and wants something done and wants the landfill closed down right away. And so there's a lot of tension there. So I think, so the next step, if you can't find that information out, is to actually just go out and start talking to people, talking to local businesses, talking to, you know, community members, churches, you know, if there are any community organizations, and finding, you know, just asking open-ended questions and reaching out to them.
I'm 100% with Elizabeth on that one. I think it's important to have community relations specialists throughout the life cycle of the project. I mean, they maintain contacts with people, you know, during the entire process, and would help you identify, you know, what the issues are surrounding that site. I know it's hard. I dealt with largely sites that were in long-term operations, maintenance, and monitoring, and by that point, a lot of the people have faded away. So it may be hard to you know, identify who the stakeholders are and you know what their issues are. But Elizabeth has some really good ideas for doing just that.
I just want to add one thing too, because I, in reading this question, I kind of get the impression that maybe the question is like, if you're hosting a public meeting and there's one person who just keeps speaking up and you're not really hearing from the rest of the attendees, and you don't know for sure that this person who's speaking up really represents all of them. If that's the scenario, I just would also recommend having multiple ways of doing outreach. So, you know, if you're just doing public meetings, you might only really hear from people who feel comfortable speaking up in those sort of scenarios. But if you're also doing targeted mailings, or door to door, or, you know, meeting people in their setting, that can really help.
Thanks, Michelle. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No worries. If you have anything else to add, Elizabeth, go for it. Otherwise, I was just going to move on to the next question.
Yeah, no, I was just going to reinforce what Michelle said, because I had mentioned this in my presentation, to make sure that you go to where they are and what's comfortable for them. So it might make, you know, it might be that you have to go out to them. So even in that scenario that Michelle was mentioning, follow up, as Michelle said, you know, and then reach out individually to the attendees.
All right. Thank you, trainers. I'm going to read one more question, and then we're going to move on to the rest of our training, and then our trainers will respond to those leftover questions via the chat, or excuse me, via text in the Q&A pod. So what are some quantitative values of ecosystem services, and is there you know, a database method or recommended framework for quantifying ecosystem services? So kind of a two-part question there, and I'm happy to repeat that for the trainers if they'd like.
Well, okay, this is Elizabeth again, and I was going to say that there are plenty of resources in the ITRC SRR guidance. There's also plenty of resources. I work for USEPA, so I'm most familiar with those resources as well. So we have our, you know, a whole team in our Office of Research and Development dedicated to ecosystem services. And I think Michelle, are you going to go into more detail about how to quantify the how to quantify ecosystem services?
Maybe a bit. I mostly will be going over the best management practices, but those do end up touching on ecosystem service quantification.
Okay. Yeah. So Devin, I was going to say also, I don't mean to punt, but if you could get the person's name and contact information, I would be happy to send them more information directly on quantification and also some contacts that they could reach out to.
Absolutely, Elizabeth. So with that, just to keep in time with our training here today, we are going to move on to the next section of the training, which is integrating SRR with Roy Hoon.
Great. Thanks, Devin. I'm waiting. I don't think I have control just yet. There we go. Okay. So today I'll be talking about Section 6, integrating SRR. It is a heavy lift, so strap in and enjoy the ride. First, we'll talk about how we're going to integrate social considerations through stakeholder engagement, and then consider natural resource use and conservation throughout the project lifecycle. We'll also look at ways to minimize a project's carbon footprint, as something everybody is attempting to do as we try to achieve our net zero goals. And then, of course, address vulnerability to changing climate, weather, and fire hazards. So this is the core tool really accessed within the guidance document that you'll find on ITRC's website. And what it shows is how a project progresses the various phases of the project lifecycle. Here on the top is the project stage or phase that we're generally familiar with, that those of us who work on remediation sites. And then on the left side, we have the integration components that intersect the tool to be able to understand the interaction between the project stage or phase and the different components that make it up. So let me go on to, let me see this click. There we go. So at the heart of every successful remediation project is really a fully vetted conceptual site model. And that's what we put at the core of this little target diagram here. You see surrounding it all the aspects of the project, including the threats from climate change and wildfire, the threat mitigation. You know, threat mitigation is really integral to the process, and that relies on, you know, stakeholder engagement, really including the incorporation of social and economic best management practices and the consideration of green and sustainable elements in the remedy selection and design, but also the incorporation of sustainable best management practices, BMPs for short, what we'll all be using throughout my section discussion, and the implementation of good operation, maintenance, and optimization of the remedy. An SRR CSM also incorporates additional elements that consider that short and long-term effects of climate change and wildfires on the resiliency of the remedial solution. And that includes the future variability of climate and weather wildfire threats. Now, stakeholder engagement, which Elizabeth talked about, in the remedy selection and also in site reuse is really important. The integration of climate and wildfire threats and stakeholder concerns in the remedy or in consideration of the remedy. And then ultimately, that CSM gets updated throughout the project lifecycle to account for the conditions and threat changes. So for those familiar with the ITRC Remediation Management of Complex Sites guidance, which was published in 2017, we modified the CSM process just a little bit by adding sustainability and remedy resilience, which you can see up near the top there in the blue box. Ultimately, the SRR conceptual site model or CSM seeks to provide the information that's necessary to consider remedies that are protective of human health, as Tom emphasized, and the environment But that's an anticipation also of more frequent and severe weather events, wildfires, and climate change hazards. While we also account for important social and economic influences to both the site and community. The SRR CSM uses forecasted changes in the frequency and severity of extreme weather events and wildfires and long-term changes as a means to consider future direct and indirect impact to the remedy. These impacts might result in reduced remedy effectiveness, and that could mean a decline in natural resources, acceleration of erosional processes, and prolonged environmental stressors such as sea level rise and drought. All of these can have an impact to the remedy. So again, it's the reason why we want to revisit that CSM. So this table, which is from section 7, which Michelle will get into more, of the guidance, it provides an example of climate change factors for the SRR CSM. Now remember, traditional CSMs typically do not incorporate sustainability considerations or resilience to local climate change impact. The lack of sustainability considerations really can result in a remedy that creates an unnecessary depletion of natural resources and also unanticipated increases in greenhouse gas emissions. You know, and I think it might have skipped us. Let's see here. Hold on a second. If I can go back. See where I'm at. There we go. Sorry about that. It skipped ahead on me. So in the absence of that local climate change data and in the CSM, remedial designs often incorporate default or regional climate information. Now, just to emphasize, as a general rule of thumb, if you can use site-specific local data, especially climate change and weather event information, it's typically going to be much better in understanding sustainability and resilience for your site. So the remedial design approach really may not necessarily generate the appropriate level of engineering resilience for the anticipated life of the remedy if you're just relying on regional or, say, larger area data sets that may or may not capture site-specific nuances. And the emerging CSM framework has also begun to recognize inadequacies in the traditional CSM approach. So stakeholder engagement, Elizabeth did a great job of covering it, and I'll touch on it even more or add to it. The social dimensions of SRR really always include or should always include consideration of stakeholders' needs and concerns, often called stakeholder values. In this context, site-specific objectives, goals, and processes for an SRR assessment are really informed by those multiple stakeholder values. And we transform that sustainable, resilient benefits and mitigation of those impacts, including looking at environmental justice, which is part of Section 5.2. And we also look at other underserved communities, which are core components to SRR. So like the CSM, stakeholder engagement evolves throughout the project lifecycle, demonstrating the importance of developing and implementing a continuous phased engagement process. Now, in this SRR guidance, like we mentioned earlier in the training, we have established three levels of SRR evaluation, which are based on the complexity and profile of the site. This allows SRR integration to be flexible and adaptable to the scope, scale, and budget. You know, identifying extreme weather and wildfire potential are important as they may influence the selection of the most important appropriate level of evaluation. You know, sites that are particularly vulnerable to extreme events may require a higher level of evaluation. I click here. There we go. So for instance, a level one would evaluate exposure scenarios and determine which extreme weather events and wildfire scenarios could occur, then adopt best management practices accordingly. And these sustainable best management practices, which are discussed in detail in the next section of the training, Section 7, a guidance document, which Michelle will cover. In level two, you add the addition to evaluations that incorporate some degree of qualitative or quantitative, semi-quantitative evaluation. For example, simple mathematical calculations and tools, weight and rack approaches, stakeholder input. Example tools would be like CIFA, or the spreadsheets for environmental footprint analysis, which EPA had created. SiteWise, which was developed by Battelle, Navy, U.S. Army Corps, and others. And then Social Sustainable Evaluation Matrix, SSEM. All three of these tools work similarly into helping to understand the sustainability of a remedial project. Level three incorporates a full vulnerability assessment with rigorous quantitative evaluation, such as climate models that are downscaled to the site, and life cycle assessment for environmental sustainability. So next we'll look at site characterization. So there are three major categories for SRR integration to consider during site characterization stage, and are different or perhaps supplemental to traditional approaches. We have, in addition to defining nature and extent of contamination, we collect data on extreme weather, wildfires, and other site-specific risks, such as sea level rise. Collecting data for resilient remedy design, like wind and temperature extremes, erosion, et cetera. And then incorporating site vulnerability and climate and fire-related risk assessments. And you'll find that the vulnerability assessments really are extremely important to this SRR process. So getting SRR data integrated early really arms you with the information that's required for informed stakeholder engagement and to set up this project for successful, sustainable site reuse outcomes. So what is required for an accurate and meaningful vulnerability assessment? Well, we build a regional and local climate data into the CSM. Site-specific data may be required. And as I said earlier, I think if you can ever get site-specific data, it's always better in terms of that sustainability and resilience aspect of SRR. Collecting data to evaluate vulnerability to climate change and extreme weather, during the remedial action and long-term site management, and assessing vulnerability and identifying data gaps that help to achieve a robust vulnerability assessment. And of course, you reevaluate the vulnerabilities and those data gaps as the remedy becomes more clear. Again, a reoccurring theme with SRR. Make sure I didn't go too far. Okay. So as you transition from the site characterization to the remedy planning phase, you need to be thinking not just about the most technically and cost-effective approaches, but also about the most sustainable and resilient approaches to meet your remedial action objectives. Now, always identify and screen, select, and design the best remedy to meet the RAOs. Also, select remedies which have low impact, that attain those RAOs and align with stakeholder and community and economic development needs. And on an ongoing basis, the remedy should be effective and resilient, both in the short term and long term. This is the best opportunity to create a lasting SRR influence on the project overall. So there are specific actions you can take during remedy planning that will influence the remedy selection and project outcomes. You can establish resilient metrics, like how will you measure resilience and what will be your design constraints? For example, how much will sea level rise? How intense and frequent will wildfires be? How intense will storms become? Just some things that help challenge you and think about those metrics. You conduct a vulnerability assessment of technologies against these metrics. And can vulnerabilities be mitigated through adaptation or sustainable best management practices? For each alternative, identify adaptation strategies and best management practices. Calculate that level of effort and cost of adaptation. There is a cost benefit for every adaptation. And document and include vulnerability assessments, sustainable best management practices, and adaptation in the remedy evaluation. And that documentation really helps with both the discussion with your stakeholders and community and regulators, and recognizes the decisions and the agreements that were made along the journey. So next we look at how to integrate SRR into the remedy design phase, which is primarily about preventing remedy failure and optimizing sustainability. You know, this follows a deliberate stepwise process. And you know, updating that vulnerability assessment, I've mentioned a few times already, probably getting the hint, to determine whether the risk is acceptable to the engineer, the regulator, and the stakeholders in the community. And then, you know, select the most sustainable and resilient approach to manage the risk in consideration of the cost benefit of that approach. And incorporate sustainable best management practices into that design. Again, document the remaining risk that was accepted. You may need to refer to the agreements made with the stakeholders in the event that there's a remedy failure, but that was in within the acceptable risk tolerance. So for every remediation project, there's a balance between risk and reward. I think we generally understand that. We cannot plan or design for every possible scenario as much as we try. And SRR is not a perfect science, but an informed process to assure a better outcome, no matter the scale or the complexity. Although climate models and our overall understanding of climate change is improving with time, there remains uncertainty, and that uncertainty is magnified when we downscale to an individual remediation site. You know, while it's safe to assume sea level will continue to rise, at least for the foreseeable future, we cannot predict accurately the rate and magnitude of sea level rise at an individual point in space. And so therefore, the principal tenets of SRR suggest we plan conservatively so that our remedies will endure throughout the project lifecycle. However, when conservative approaches greatly increase cost, it may not be practical or even possible to implement them. Therefore, we introduce and accept risk in remedy planning, and we negotiate that risk with our stakeholders to achieve reasonable expectations for project outcomes. You know, when we consider remediation risk management, think about vulnerability. Is the remedy vulnerable? Right? And resilience, is the remedy resilient to the identified vulnerabilities? And also sustainability, are there unintended impacts that require mitigation? You know, one example is sometimes when we think about sustainability, we focus so heavily on greenhouse gas emissions, and we forget that sustainability also looks at resource utilization, water, soil, natural resources, lumber, et cetera. All of those are part of the sustainability equation. And for more information on this topic of risk management, you can look at the 2011 Project Risk Management for Site Remediation Guidance that ITRC developed. So the OMM stage, or Operation Maintenance and Monitoring, for active remedial solutions, it's often the longest stage in the project lifecycle, and therefore can have a large footprint. Now, given OM&M can continue for decades, the vulnerability risk is high, and it increases with time due to climate change, extreme weather events, and wildfires. Therefore, resiliency is a key factor during OM&M. For example, a capping system designed to reduce infiltration, it must be resilient to extreme weather and climate-related degradation permanently, or at least until the waste beneath is environmentally degraded. The cost benefit of resilience during O&M is a key business factor affecting responsible parties. For example, an inexpensive prefabricated treatment shed, it may represent a low capital cost during construction, but the cost of replacement must be considered in the context of the treatment shed's resiliency to extreme weather and wildfires, you know, where it may not be the lowest life cycle cost, and ultimately may not receive stakeholder acceptance. So some things to consider. Now, looking at optimization, by its nature, is an SRR activity. Optimization often presents a unique opportunity to reduce the environmental footprint of the remedy. There are many types of optimization activities, including reducing redundancy and incorporating more efficient procedures, revisiting design assumptions against changed or anticipated conditions, transitioning to an adaptive strategy, But unfortunately, you know, it's often a poor remediation track record that presents the opportunity for optimization to add benefit. In other words, what responsible parties will often find themselves in the face of is either stakeholders and or agencies that are screaming for something to change because the remedy is not performing as anticipated, and thus the opportunity for optimization. Ultimately, we get to site reuse. You know, the reuse and redevelopment phase really provides an opportunity to positively affect the community. Ideally, reuse has been baked into the project from the onset, but there are still opportunities to influence the sustainability of the site going forward. You continue to your engagement with stakeholders in the community, as we've talked about, that really goes on throughout the life cycle of the project. And you can make an improvement to things like to the area that have been historically oppressed by inequitable environmental conditions. You know, future climate change needs to be addressed to ensure long-term protectiveness, right? Is the reuse plan resilient to extreme weather events and wildfire? It's a posed question. Perform or revisit the vulnerability assessment. I probably mentioned it almost 10 times now. Can the remedy accommodate identified climate change risk factors concerning a long-term reuse plan? And this is something that's becoming more in vogue with brownfields redevelopments, you know, considering not just the development and the economic opportunity for the community, but also the long-term sustainability of that project itself. Cost-benefit analysis. Is it an efficient use of the resources to design and construct for resilience, or as opposed to reserving for potential uncertain cost of repairs? It's the constant battle that we have, even as homeowners, right? Gee, do I build something stronger and pay more money now, or can I just wait and save my pennies and just deal with it when it breaks and just pay for the repair? That's no different when we look at remediation sites, and that's something that you have to consider. So have a few case studies, or actually a case study, which we'll look at in depth. For illustrative purposes, we'll look at the Pharmacia Upjohn case study that was presented in the guidance. The Pharmacia site is located in North Haven, Connecticut, along the Quinnipiac River. It was formerly mined for clay for brick production and then used for chemical and electronics manufacturing. This case study predates the new SRR guidance, but is an excellent example of incorporation of sustainable best management practices and a community-driven outcome. During the site characterization stage, Pharmacia implemented and documented many practical SRR components that are listed on the slide. What is noteworthy about these priorities is that many serve the dual purpose of carbon footprint and cost reduction. Also noteworthy, the process from the project planning through site reuse requires perseverance and dedication. It can take a long time and is often not linear. And any folks that have worked on a brownfield project absolutely know bringing all the pieces together to make that project happen take a long time. Moving on. So when we continue to look at Pharmacia, this time as an example of how SRR best management practices were incorporated into the remedy design and execution stages of the project. Here were the highest priority SRR considerations for each remedial component of the projects. The capping systems and hydraulic barrier at Pharmacia were used to control groundwater migration and prevent impacts of sensitive ecosystems. They reduced infiltration and accommodate the on-site consolidation of contaminated soils. The SRR considerations include excellent examples of the use of on-site, local and recycled materials, and the incorporation of vegetation and the enhancement of habitat to support biodiversity. We often start thinking of biodiversity as natural capital these days, a great term. So incorporating SRR throughout the remedial project lifecycle, beginning at the project planning phase and then including a robust stakeholder engagement process really has driven the Pharmacy at Upjohn project forward with a vision for the site reuse in mind. At Pharmacia, a sustainable outcome to remediation is being realized, one that takes into account the environmental, social, and economic aspects of sustainability. And they're built around a resilient remediation and enduring reuse plan. So by creating habitat, opening the site to the community as an ecological preserve, and retaining a portion of the property for commercial development, the end state of this project addresses the social, environmental, and economic needs of the community. So, in summary, here are the main takeaways from the integrating SRR section. Accounting for variability of climate and wildfire threats throughout the project lifecycle can substantially reduce long-term site management risks. Early stakeholder engagement can greatly help inform the social and economic aspects for a sustainable remedy. And the SRR-CSM integration of climate and wildfire data, along with stakeholder perspectives, provides for sustainable and resilient decision-making throughout the project lifecycle. Well, hopefully you've enjoyed hearing about section 6 of the SRR guidance. At this point, I'm ready to hand it over to Michelle, who will talk about sustainable best management practices. There you go, Michelle.
Great. Thank you, Roy. Just waiting to gain control over these slides.
I give it to you, Michelle, if you want to. Oh, perfect.
There we go. Okay. So before we get too deep on this topic, you might be wondering, why do we call these sustainable BMPs or SBMPs? Because usually they're just called BMPs. Well, the BMPs that we include in this guidance are not just effective and practical methods to build or adapt a cleanup site to climate change. They also minimize impact or damage to the environment and community. Remember, the resilient cleanups guidance builds on its GSR predecessors. So where can you get all of the gems that I'm about to share with you? Well, if we look at the main guidance webpage, you can use the navigation pane on the left and go to section 7. You've heard the importance and the why and the how of SRR so far in this presentation, but you are probably still asking, what do I actually do to make the cleanup resilient? That's where the SBMP section comes in. In this section, we will give you the SBMPs, yes, but we will also pair those with key resources, background information, and additional things to consider. These things added together equal a resilient cleanup approach. Looking back at the navigation pane on the left side of the webpage, you can see the SBMPs are organized by weather or climate events that may become extreme, either in duration, intensity, frequency, or location. Throughout this module, I will simply refer to them as extreme events. There is also a category for SBMPs that are universally relevant regardless of which extreme event may impact the cleanup. The extreme events included in this guidance are wind, snow and hail, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, flooding, bank and shoreline erosion, pre-wildfire, post-wildfire, sea level rise, evapotranspiration, storm surge, and permafrost thaw. Due to the depth of information on wildfires, we actually included two sections on wildfires, one for adapting ahead of wildfire, that's the pre-wildfire section, and one for adapting after a wildfire has occurred at the remediation site, and that's the post-wildfire section. Each extreme event section includes an overview of how the extreme events generally impact remediations. This allows you to gain a better understanding of the importance of the SBMPs included in that guidance. We also point out which extreme events are related to the ones you are reading about. We call these secondary or cascading extreme events because they may happen at the site for the same reason as the primary event happens. For example, evapotranspiration and fluctuating groundwater levels happen under similar environmental conditions, or a secondary event may happen as a result of the primary event, such as flash flooding after a wildfire. As Roy described, the outer ring of any remediation includes climate and wildfire threats. These threats surround all aspects of the remediation project. So we organize the SBMPs within each extreme event by remediation project phase to make it very easy for you to find the SBMPs you need at any phase of the cleanup. We also included vulnerability assessment and crisis management SBMPs relevant to the specific extreme event you are exploring. I'm now going to show you how flexible and practical the SBMP guidance is. I'll show you how to step through the SBMP process using Figure 7-1 in the guidance. Then I will discuss a few of the universally relevant SBMPs and use a case study from the guidance to demonstrate specifics. So how do you get started? Well, you enter the SBMP cycle based on a trigger. There are three possible triggers. One, you may know that the site is in a region with a general vulnerability, such as having less precipitation in the area. Two, an extreme event may have actually occurred, such as the site was flooded. Or three, you've done a comprehensive vulnerability assessment. If trigger number two or three is how you entered, then you can go right to the extreme event sections of the guidance to find the appropriate SBMPs. However, if trigger number one brought you here, which again was just a general knowledge of climate conditions in the region, you may need help identifying applicable extreme events. For example, you know your region generally is experiencing decreasing precipitation. You can use Table 7-1 to navigate to the relevant extreme events by simply following the row for precipitation decrease, and wherever an X is in the column, navigate to that extreme event. And this table in the guidance is actually hyperlinked, so you can just click on any of those column headings to go right to the section that is relevant for you. Once you know the primary vulnerabilities, you would read the overview sections for each extreme event and to identify the associated secondary or cascading extreme events to also review. After identifying all applicable primary and secondary extreme events, you can either read the SBMPs in the text of the guidance, or you can use the fully customizable tool we provide you as Appendix D. So this is a screenshot of the tool. And when we developed this guidance, one of the most important priorities for us was to make sure it was thorough and comprehensive, something you could really use to get beyond the concept and into implementation. We researched every single source we could find and consolidated 313 SBMPs into this one-stop shop guidance. In addition to being really thorough, another top priority, though, was making the guidance easy to use. This tool was developed and included to allow you to completely customize it to the cleanup site specifications you're dealing with. The tool is filterable by extreme event and phase of the project, and the tool is fillable for documenting which SBMPs are applicable and which were implemented. So now I will give you a taste of some of the SBMPs that are universally applicable regardless of the extreme events the cleanup is vulnerable to. Again, the guidance itself goes really in depth with many universally applicable SBMPs, and then, of course, SBMPs by extreme event. I can only share a couple during this training for timing, but if you make use of the guidance, you will find a wealth of information. So a few SBMPs for assessing vulnerability can include assuming the site is vulnerable to known vulnerabilities. And I know this might sound obvious, but sometimes it's really easy for us to overlook the obvious. So if the site is in a 500-year floodplain, go ahead and assume it is vulnerable to flooding. Don't assume that a 500-year event isn't applicable to your 30-year remedy. Instead, consider that flooding is likely to increase in frequency, intensity, or duration. Second, review the secondary or cascading events we identify for you in the overview section for each extreme event. And third, review local vulnerability information. These are identified in each extreme event section in the resources and in the resources map, which Tom talked about at the top and is a major hub of tools. During the planning and prioritization phase of a cleanup, some SBMPs you can always implement are to seek and review traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK. TEK is uniquely defined by each tribe. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has generalized the definition as the evolving knowledge acquired by indigenous and local peoples over hundreds or thousands of years through direct contact with the environment. It is specific to a location and includes the relationships between the environment and people. It is not a static understanding of how the environment was. It continues to evolve and identify changes in the environment. It is an important part of the tribal consultation process and may be relevant even where formal consultation is not required and for sites located not located on tribal reservations. We go in depth on this in the guidance, so I highly encourage you to read this portion of the guidance document. Another BMP during planning and prioritizing is putting SRR into your request for proposals and scopes of work to ensure that contracts will be set up with SRR in mind. And a third SBMP is that extreme events can create financial risk. So use the case studies in Appendix A of the guidance to gain insight on predicting financial risk from extreme events. During remedy design and implementation, you can use green infrastructure and natural solutions such as plants native to the existing climate with tolerances for the likely future climate. I saw one of the commenters was asking about living shorelines. Living shorelines would be another natural solution to adapting your site to sea level rise or storm surge, and those SBMPs are included in those extreme event sections. You can also stormproof infrastructure on site and consider partnering with the community to stormproof critical access or operational infrastructure that's not actually on site. And you can document your SBMP selection and prioritization process. And whether they were implemented is key for reviewing effectiveness during periodic reviews or after crisis management. Speaking of periodic review, one of the top SBMPs you can implement is to update the vulnerability assessment on a defined and periodic basis and adapt SBMP implementation to match any changing site conditions. Also, review the CSM on a defined and periodic basis to determine if adaptations to remedy design and construction need to be made. This review can be on the same timeline as the vulnerability assessment review, and you can streamline both of them by coupling them with any other OM&M inspection, monitoring, maintenance, or reporting requirements. Also, after any extreme event, you will want to evaluate the performance of the SBMPs. Did they work as expected? Do you need to make any engineering tweaks, etc.? One phase of the project you may not yet be familiar with, but which is predicted to increase as extreme events increase at cleanup sites, is crisis management. When responding to an extreme event, it is important to reevaluate site boundaries and potential pathways for contaminant migration, because these might have changed as a result of the extreme event impacting your site. And second, reassess monitoring and sampling protocols. These are both important because the extreme event may have opened new pathways for migration and may even have changed the chemicals of concern. You should also revise safety procedures to reflect the increased likelihood, duration, or intensity of the extreme event. So I'm now going to take you through that theoretical generic process on a case study. I pulled this case study from Appendix A of the guidance because it was a site that was already well into OM&M when resilience was considered. I know many of us believe that adaptation can only really be integrated during the planning and design phases. And even though you've heard us say it throughout this presentation, that it can happen at any stage, and you've seen some general ideas of that, you may still not really believe it. So I hope this case study shows you that it is possible. This case study is for the Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site, which is in its sixth five-year review. So this is a large site with historic acid mine drainage, discharges to multiple waterways, including a source of drinking water. The remedial action objective is to eliminate those discharges, and several interim remedies have been put in place to control the source, including acid mine drainage, collection and treatment, and water management. So what brought this cleanup into the SBMP process? Well, the trigger was that wildfires and severe storms created significant challenges for site operators. Although the remedies are operating as intended, climate change was not given the level of consideration this guidance recommends early on. The treatment was not built with resilience to wildfires or severe storms in mind. The ongoing extreme events necessitate resiliency improvements. The next step then is to identify and prioritize the SBMPs. Start by reviewing the wind, pre and post wildfire and universally applicable SBMP overview sections. This will help you identify the secondary or cascading extreme events. Sites vulnerable to high winds may also be vulnerable to storm surge, bank and shoreline erosion, or evapotranspiration. And sites vulnerable to wildfire risk may also be vulnerable to flooding, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, or permafrost thaw. Now, I think you can tell not all of these secondary vulnerabilities will be relevant to a site. Knowledge about where the cleanup is located can narrow down the additional extreme events to review. For example, this site, Iron Mountain Mine, is not located on an ocean shoreline or in the Arctic Circle, so storm surge and permafrost thaw are not relevant and can be eliminated from future review. To identify only the SBMPs relevant to the extreme events of concern at your site, use Appendix D, the tool to identify the SBMPs. For Iron Mountain Mine, you would start by filtering the extreme event column to only view SBMPs for wind, pre-wildfire, post-wildfire, flooding, fluctuating groundwater elevation levels, bank and shoreline erosion, and evapotranspiration. You also always want to review the universally applicable SBMPs. Even though it sounds like we selected a lot, this actually shortens the list from 313 SBMPs to 198. Whoops, I have to go back. Sorry about that. Okay, and then you can further shorten the list by filtering based on the phase of remediation. So the Iron Mountain Mine is already in implementation in OM&M, so you would filter the description column to view only the SBMPs for remedy design and implementation, OM&M, and general, because general kind of covers any phase of the cleanup. Because extreme events have already occurred, you also want to include crisis management SBMPs. And with this filtering, you've now cut the list of SBMPs by more than half, down to 128. This is where the tool gets really awesome, because as you read through the SBMPs, you can use the tool to fill in which ones are applicable and which ones are not applicable. You can then filter to only view the applicable SBMPs. Applicable SBMPs can then be sorted based on priority, or you can move them around or break them into new worksheets or add columns to denote priority, or add your own notes. Basically, do whatever works for you. Since it's fully customizable, it can facilitate discussions with a client, a contractor, a regulator, or the community. You can work on it together or provide it as a deliverable. Another feature is that it can be your documentation tool, where you know which SBMPs were implemented and any tweaks you had to make in the field, etc. Plus, you can come back to this completed tool later to assist you with your SBMP evaluation during periodic site reviews. To make Iron Mountain Mine more resilient to wildfires and storms, the following SBMPs were implemented. They replaced portions of the treatment system with non-flammable stainless steel. They added redundancies in the treatment system. They developed vegetation management, especially with plants that effectively spread fires. They continue and increase coordination with local emergency responders. And a couple that they're still working on are updating the emergency preparedness plan and updating the asset management plan. The effectiveness of the SBMPs is reviewed at Iron Mountain Mine on a periodic and defined basis. This site is subject to five-year reviews, and as part of that process, CAL FIRE conducts on-site visits to advise on fire prevention measures. If your cleanup site is not subject to five-year reviews or any mandatory review of OM&M, long-term stewardship, or land use controls, implement a review anyway. Climate change is evolving quickly, and Roy showed us how errors increase with longer modeling timeframes. One way to overcome this uncertainty in time is through regular review of site conditions and updated climate projections. Regulators can consider requiring periodic review to ensure the long-term effectiveness of the remedy and protection of human health and the environment as site conditions change. And responsible parties should volunteer periodic review in order to reduce their own liability as site conditions change. Does the review always need to be on a five-year basis? No. If you're not required to do five-year reviews, consider defining the periodic review time period as one that makes sense for your location, vulnerabilities, and community. We go in depth on how to do this in the guidance. Reevaluating the site vulnerabilities at Iron Mountain Mine occurs at the same time as evaluating SBMP effectiveness. It's all part of the five-year review. The best way to reevaluate vulnerabilities is to perform a vulnerability assessment for the site. At Iron Mountain Mine, one way they assess vulnerability is to run climate change scenarios in their water quality model. So to conclude, the SBMP portion of this guidance is flexible in three ways. First, logistically, you can read it or you can use the customizable tool. Second, it's adaptable to any cleanup site under any cleanup program at any phase, not just for Superfund and not just during planning and design, all programs and all phases. And third, there are no required or mandatory SBMPs. You can find whatever relates to the extreme event and your phase of cleanup in order to implement what's applicable. The guidance is also comprehensive. With 313 SBMPs and tons of information to help you understand the importance of each one and why it was included, we scoured hundreds of sources, and they are all linked throughout the guidance and in the resources map, making this a one-stop shop for information on resilience. We also include SBMPs for responding to an extreme event, because crisis management is becoming increasingly important as climate changes. and the guidance is easy. We make it easy for you to identify secondary or cascading extreme events. We link to other parts of the guidance that go more in depth, such as demographic analysis, and we tell you which resources are likely to be more useful for that extreme event. We made you a tool that you can custom tailor to your individual cleanup and use for documentation, evaluation, and information sharing. So now I've told you the what of SRR implementation. You are ready. You're ready to find the relevant SBMPs based on the likely extreme events for any phase of the remediation. You now know how to understand your site vulnerabilities based on the information about the site location or extreme events having occurred or from conducting a full vulnerability assessment using the tools provided. You know how to identify the relevant SBMPs by reading Section 7 of the guidance, navigating to the extreme events that the site is vulnerable to, and using the fully customizable tool in Appendix D. You also know how to work with the project team and stakeholders to implement the SBMPs. This includes periodic review of the site vulnerabilities and evaluation of the SBMP effectiveness. You came to this portion of the training understanding the importance of an adaptive remedy, and now you have all the tools you need to easily find the right adaptive measures for your cleanup and ensure a resilient remedy that is protective of human health and the environment. I will now hand it back to the moderator for Q&A.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. So we will... We will jump right into our last Q&A here, and then we will wrap up the training today. So with that, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod and see if we have questions for our trainers. If you have anything that you would like our trainers to answer, please put it in the Q&A pod now, and we will address it. So our first question, do the BMPs have an environmental assessment associated with them?
Excuse me. So I'm not exactly sure what that question means, an environmental assessment. We do have vulnerability assessment associated with them, if that's what you're trying to get at, where we recommend how to identify the climate threats that might be impacting the site.
Right. Thank you, Michelle. I will just note that the question, it looked to me as though there was it says assessant, and I assume that was assessment, but I don't know if that sparks anything for you, Michelle, different in terms of a response. Next question, crisis management, would that be similar to reactive management? Do you have any thoughts on this in terms of the two compared?
Possibly. If there's a like definition for reactive management, I guess I don't know exactly what that definition is, you know, if that's defined by some regulatory agency. But in general, the idea behind crisis management is that you are responding after the fact. So an extreme event has occurred at your remediation. You know, the site has experienced flooding. And now, you know, you've got the normal, I have to go respond, get this cleanup remedy back, you know, working again, get the equipment turned back on, whatever the case may be. And then our SBMPs take you further into, okay, now you know you've had a flood here. What can you do to sustainably ensure that this site becomes resilient to future flooding? That's where our BMPs are focused in this guidance, is always about how to make your site become adaptive to a climate threat.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that. You know, I spent a good portion of my career with BP, and we often got into this debate in managing remediation portfolios as to using discretionary spend to be proactive versus reactive, meaning after an event occurs or after you're directed by a regulatory agency to do something. And, you know, in practice, you know, it's clear to see that if you can plan ahead and be proactive, you know, with almost great certainty, the outcome will be better than having to address something after the fact. And when it comes to extreme weather and climate change, usually the results of being reactive are not only going to cost you more, but also impact you reputationally. And that's clearly something to think about if you have a choice between being proactive and reactive.
And Roy, I think you also pointed out earlier, either in the chat or during your presentation, the remediation risk management document that ITRC has. It outlines a really good way of approaching crisis management and risk management, in that you plan for it, you react to it, and then you learn from the results of that particular event and feed that back into the planning loop. So, you know, there are resources available to process this concept.
All right. Thank you, trainers. How sensitive are the BMPs to environmental conditions?
Again, the BMPs are written specific to each climate threat. So the environmental conditions are the basis of the BMP recommendations. I'm not sure if you meant something else by environmental conditions, but I mean, I guess my recommendation is that you start by looking at Section 7, clicking through each of those 10 or so extreme events, and sort of getting a sense of what the guidance defines as those environmental conditions likely to exist as a result of those extreme events, and then the BMPs are directly tied to that.
Yeah, again, whether you're looking at ASTM standard with their sustainable best management practices or our guidance here, you do need to make sure you understand the nature of the SBMP. Most are geared towards reduction of natural resource use, or so conservation of resources, or reduction in carbon footprint. From a resilience standpoint, that's where I think the question's coming from. It would be wise to do your own evaluation with respect to the vulnerabilities to extreme weather events, fire, earthquake, climate change, sea level rise, et cetera, because it may fall outside the context of how that best management practice was developed. So just food for thought.
Yeah, I guess I will just add on to that by saying, so are the BMPs in this guidance are sustainable BMPs. So the purpose of them is to ensure that your cleanup site is resilient to the climate threats that your site is facing. But we don't include ways to do that aren't sustainable. So that means there may be other ways to do that. For example, hardscaping can be helpful in adapting your site, making it more resilient to things like flooding, but that's not very sustainable. So we only include the BMPs that are such as, you know, using native vegetation, or, you know, constructing a wetland, using green infrastructure, that kind of thing. So there might be more BMPs out there that will help your site adapt to those environmental conditions that are likely to occur as a result of climate change, but they're not necessarily sustainable.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So we have reached the time end for our training here. So I am going to wrap up our training. We would love to hear back from everybody today on how the training went. So please take a moment to fill out the feedback form. It is linked here on this last slide. But again, this link is not active. So it is on the training page that brought you here today from Kluin. So that is also completing the feedback form is also how you would receive a certificate of completion. If you are interested, fill out that form and it will be emailed to you afterwards. And I just want to say thank you to all of our attendees today and for all of those wonderful questions. If you have any further questions or would like any further clarification on any questions that were asked or answers provided, you feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we'll follow up with our trainers to get those questions answered. You're also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Their information is on the Clumen training page as well, if you're interested in that path. So again, I just want to say thank you to our attendees and thank you to our trainers. We appreciate you all taking the time out of your days to join us here. And remember that we do archive all of our classes. So if you find that you have any extra time or are interested in any additional training topics, they are all on the Clumen website. So feel free to peruse that and see if anything interests you. We do have one last IBT online webinar before the end of the year here, and it is in situ later in December. So I just wanted to remind everybody of that. But otherwise, I hope everybody has a wonderful rest of their day. And if you celebrate the holiday season's coming in the next week or so, I hope you have a wonderful holiday season as well. So I'll just end the training here and thank you all and have a wonderful rest of your day.